the person you're going to be talking to us about is Adolf Galland, is that right?
Yes, that's right, Adolf Galland, also named Dolfo by his comrades. And actually, this time I didn't have to do any translation work, or hardly any, because I have the English translation of his autobiography. So let's get started. He was quite the character. There was certainly no lack in personality concerning Adolf Galland. Even when he was featured in the Wochenschau, the German newsreel, this was obvious when in contrast to the other people featured. You would see him grimacing and grinning, clowning around, at least before he was promoted to ranks with higher responsibility. He was known for having a Mickey Mouse painting holding an axe and a gun painted on his aircraft. He was known sometimes to fly combat missions in bathing trunks with a cigar between his teeth. He also had an ashtray and a cigarette holder installed into his cockpit. Perhaps what James Doolittle, the U.S. Air Force general, said about him sums it all up. The Luftwaffe produced many outstanding aces, but only one Adolf Galland. He was born in Westerhold, Westphalia, on the 19th of March 1912, as the second born of four sons of their father, Adolf Galland Sr. All four of them served in the Luftwaffe, and his two younger brothers became Experten, or aces, just like Adolf. He came in contact with the world of aviation when a glider club was formed nearby when he was 17. Soon Adolf was enthusiastic about this new sport that was actively promoted by the German authorities. He was so good at it that he became an instructor before he had even finished his school years. At the age of 20, he did graduate from the Hindenburg Gymnasium and decided to keep pursuing his interest in flying by applying for admission to the Deutsche Verkehrsfliegerschule, German Air Traffic School. Out of 4,000 people applying, he was among the 18 that were accepted. Like the other pilots we have talked about, he did have his initial problems. One time he broke the undercarriage of the aircraft he was flying because he had touched down too hard. And somewhat later he was involved in a mid-air collision of two airplanes in a formation of three. Nobody was killed or seriously injured in these incidents, but they demoralized Galland, and he actually expected to be dismissed from the school. So he applied to join the German army, the Reichswehr, because this is still the Weimar Republic we are talking about. So it wasn't the Wehrmacht yet. But while he was awaiting a reply from the army, he kept on attending the school. When the army finally replied and told him they had accepted his application, the school actually refused to release him because in the meantime he had made such progress. So Galland trained on many different types of airplanes, mostly the large heavy ones, including flying boats. By now it's 1933, and some military people in civilian uniforms show up to talk to the trainee pilots. They inform them of a secret military program that involved flying high-performance aircraft. They all knew what that means, and all the pilots accepted the invitation to join that organization. And there he met Göring for the first time and was quite impressed. He was then sent to Italy to train with the Italian Air Force. After his return to Germany, as he still formally was training at the air traffic school, he started flying civilian airliners on the Lufthansa Stuttgart-Barcelona line. He enjoyed the lifestyle of an airline pilot, you know, getting to know different places, the prestige. So he found it quite a dilemma when near the end of 33 he was offered to join the newly formed Luftwaffe. In the end, however, the adventure of flying high-performance military aircraft, he just could not resist that, and so it was settled. After basic army training, In early 35, he was ordered to report to Jagdgeschwader 2, Fighter Wing 2. In October of the same year, during aerobatics training, he crashed his airplane, a Focke Wulf 44, a biplane, and was so severely injured that he was in a coma for 3 days. One of the injuries was a damaged eye, and because of that, he was declared unfit for flying. But an officer friend of his kept the medical report secret, and so Galland was able to continue flying. But then in October 36, he crashed an Arado 68, another biplane fighter. Well, the first one wasn't a fighter, but this one was. He was hospitalized again, and his eye was made even worse, having glass splinters in it. He was ordered to undergo tests to determine whether he could still see well enough to keep flying. One of his brothers, keep in mind they were also in the Luftwaffe, his three brothers, managed to get hold of the charts for the test. Galland memorized these charts and was able to pass the test, and he got the permission to keep flying. In 1937, he volunteered to join the Condor Legion in Spain to help Spain's nationalist and traditionalist forces in their struggle against the communist forces. The nationalists were supported by Germany and Italy, and the communists by the Soviet Union and Mexico. Mexico had a socialist government at the time. Galland was appointed Staffelkapitän, a squadron leader, and flying the Heinkel 51 biplane, ground attack version, he received his baptism of fire. He gathered experience in the ground attacks and started to write down what he thought were the best tactics. What he learned was passed on to the Luftwaffe and helped in forming the Luftwaffe doctrines and the development of the Stuka. He avoided any dogfights with the Russian-delivered I-16 monoplane fighter with retractable landing gear, also known as Rata or Rat by the nationalists. It was much faster than his biplane, and the nationalists didn't really have a counter against them until Germany started delivering the Messerschmitts or BF-109 by its official designation to Spain. After the nationalists under Franco had won, Galland was awarded the Spanish Cross in gold with swords and diamonds for his contributions.
So that was his first award then that he'd won for in battle, yeah?
Yes, indeed.
That's quite
early. This was his first experience with war, and yes, he didn't get the German decorations until somewhat later, but Spain seems to have been very thankful.
I was wondering, when you said about his eyes there, I can remember being taught you have to have absolutely perfect vision to fly a plane. So to think he had that damage done and yet was still able to fly a plane and then went on to have this illustrious career that we're going to hear about, that's quite something to think that he was doing that with substandard eyesight. It must have been a permanent injury, I would have thought, damaging his eye like that. Did you find out any more about this injury?
Nothing in particular, but I also think that this would even mess with the ability to judge distances if one eye is damaged. And so it's all the more amazing that he shot the aircraft, but we will hear about that.
Yeah, you've got to have two eyes for perspective and depth. So that's another amazing thing. Last week when you were talking about the guy that was shooting without the sights on his rifle, and this week we've got a pilot who could only see out of one eye. And quite amazing people that we have within our race, I think.
I actually remember this guy now. Yeah, from the documentary, this is the guy who expected Italy to attack Britain, was surprised at the attack on Russia, or Soviet Union rather. Yeah, I remember him now.
Okay, if you want to continue, Schmidt.
Yes. He was replaced by Werner Mölders, another famous experte, or ace. But before leaving Spain in May of 38, he made 10 flights in the Messerschmitt 109 and was extremely impressed with the performance of the aircraft. He decided he wanted to become a fighter pilot instead of a ground attack pilot at this point in time. The summer of 38 he spent in Spanish Morocco, recovering from the stress of flying combat missions. He had flown 300 of these when he was with the Condor Legion. After his return to Germany, he was ordered to the headquarters of the Ministry of Aviation, where he was tasked with finalizing his concepts of close air support and other tactical issues connected to military aviation. These concepts and doctrines would greatly help the Luftwaffe in the years ahead. Only after copying these would the Allied air forces slowly catch up with Germany as the war progressed. Unfortunately for Galland, his excellence on these subjects was responsible for the fact that he was ordered to test fly prototype reconnaissance and strike aircraft. Strike aircraft is the military term in the English-speaking world for airplanes used in the ground attack role. The Germans called these Schlachtflugzeug or battle planes. While most pilots would probably have been elated at this prospect, Galland wasn't pleased, as he wanted to fly the Messerschmitt 109 and be a fighter pilot. After some time serving as a test pilot, Galland was appointed group commander of Schlachtlehrgeschwader 2, the second group. So again, not what he wanted. He would again be flying strike aircraft. Just before the outbreak of the World War, Galland was promoted to captain. During the Poland campaign, he flew the Heinzel 123, a biplane in the ground attack role, which he had positively evaluated when he was test flying them. When he went out alone on a reconnaissance mission in a Fieseler Storch, the same type of airplane used to rescue Mussolini, he was nearly shot down. Galland and his men flew intensive combat missions in support of the German ground troops. On September the 11th, Adolf Hitler arrived at the headquarters of the Lehrgeschwader for lunch with the staff, and this is where Galland met him for the first time. 2 days later, after having flown hundreds of combat missions in two wars, Galland was finally awarded the Iron Cross, second class. After the Poland campaign was over, Galland claimed to be suffering from rheumatism and that this condition was worsened by flying in an open cockpit aircraft such as the Heinzel 123. To his great delight, his reasoning was accepted, and he was then transferred to Jagdgeschwader 27, and they were flying his loved 109s. Whether he actually did suffer from rheumatism is hard to tell, but as we know about his ruse to keep on flying in spite of his damaged eye, it's certainly possible that also in this case he used a bit of trickery to fly the airplane he loved. During the time of the Sitzkrieg, or phony war, it was called that because France had declared war on Germany, but there was quite a long time before any serious military actions took place. Galland met up with Mölders again. Mölders was at that time the most successful fighter pilot in the Luftwaffe, and he tried to teach Galland everything he had learned about leadership in the air, tactics and organization. Mölder was squadron commodore of Jagdgeschwader 53, and to teach Galland the practical side of it, he took him with him, with his people, his own people from the 53, on patrols along the French border. Mölders was the man most responsible for developing the fighter tactics of the Luftwaffe, which again the Allies started to copy after a while. Then on the 10th of May 1940, the France campaign started in all seriousness. Galland, acting as group commander, was so busy with the logistical and staff work that he had to literally steal away, in his own words, for any combat sortie. 2 days into the campaign, he achieved his first aerial victory, but he did not just shoot down one enemy airplane. Galland felt that the Messerschmitt 109E version he was flying was superior in several aspects to the British Hurricane. And keeping that in mind, I'll read how Galland describes this encounter in the air. This is from the official English translation of his autobiography called The Ersten und die Letzten, or The First and the Last. quoting, "Therefore, it was not particularly heroic when some 5 miles west of Liège, my flight companion and I dove from an altitude of about 12,000 feet on a flight of 8 hurricanes, flying 3,000 feet below us. The route had been practiced innumerable times." This might have to be routine, but it says route in this English translation. "The hurricanes had not yet spotted us. I was neither excited nor did I feel any hunting fever. Come on, defend yourself, I thought, as soon as I had one of the 8 in my gun sight. I closed in more and more without being noticed. Someone ought to warn him, but that would have been even more stupid than the strange thoughts which ran through my head at that moment. I gave him my first burst from a distance, which, considering the situation, was still too great. I was dead on the target. The poor devil at last noticed what it was all about. It took rather clumsy avoiding action, which brought him into the fire of my companion. The other 7 hurricanes made no effort to come to the aid of their comrade in distress, but made off in all directions. After a second attack, my opponent spun down in spirals, minus his rudder. Parts of the wings came off. Another burst would have been a waste of ammunition. I immediately went after another of these scattered hurricanes. This one tried to escape by diving, but I was soon on her tail, at a distance of 100 yards. The Belgian did a half-roll and disappeared through a hole in the clouds. I did not lose track of him and attacked again from very close quarters. The plane zoomed for a second, stalled, and dove vertically to the ground from a height of only 1,500 feet. During a patrol flight that afternoon, I shot down my 3rd opponent out of a formation of 5 hurricanes near Tirlemont. And I should say that he writes that it was a Belgian, and he thought so even until he wrote this autobiography in 1954. But much later, it turned out that these were actually British pilots. I guess if he had already identified the plane as a Hurricane, he probably much more care to look at the insignia, and also there's this his bad eye. I took all this quite naturally, the matter of course. I'm continuing the quote here. "There was nothing special about it. I had not felt any excitement, and I was not even particularly elated by my success. That only came much later, when we had to deal with much tougher adversaries, when each relentless aerial combat was a question of you or me. On that particular day, I had something approaching a twinge of conscience. The congratulations of my superiors and my comrades left an odd taste in my mouth. An excellent weapon and luck had been on my side. To be successful, the best fighter pilot needs both." End quote. And on the 19th, he shot down a French Potez aircraft, which was strafing German convoys. There was a wild chase over the fields and hedges, with him flying only a few feet above the ground, well, both of them. The light was fading because it was a 9:45 p.m., but then he finally got him as the French pilot started to pull up. The next day, he claimed another 3 victories, which brought his total to 7. And for that, he was awarded the Iron Cross First Class. And it was presented to him by Erhard Milch, the half-Jewish field marshal who was in charge of aircraft production. Over Dunkirk, he encountered British Supermarine Spitfires for the first time. And this time, he was quite impressed with these aircraft and with the pilots. He shot down a British Bristol Blenheim bomber, and soon after that, his first Spitfire. On June the 6th, he was appointed commander of the 3rd Group of Jagdgeschwader 26, so he changed from the 27 to the 26. Galland and his group were ordered home to the Reich to be refitted. Their losses in men and material had been small. Then the order came that he and his men should protect from the air, the airspace over Berlin, because Adolf Hitler was to give the speech in which he offered peace to England. Galland writes that one bomb on the Kroll Opera House where Hitler spoke, would have eliminated the entire German high command. And now came the time of the Battle of Britain, but we will hear about this next week.
So that was right up to one of the peace offers that he made. 27 peace offers he made in all, Hitler made in all. They probably find that he made even more at some point in the future. I remember reading it was 20 peace offers a while back. And then someone did some recent research and said that there was actually 27 that he actually made. Think of that, 27 peace offers. And we turned him down on every single one. Shocking.
Yeah, we did.
That's quite an incredible kill rate, really, when you think about it. Just starting off, and he's got 3 in one day, 4 in the next day. And he's only got vision in one eye.
Yes, that is quite unusual for a fighter pilot, and Mulder and Galland actually agreed on that it was very important. They learned that by experience when they were teaching the young ones to be a fighter pilot, that the first air victory was very important. If it went well, then there was a real boost of confidence for that pilot usually. And if in his first combat mission he got into real trouble, that would usually demoralize the pilot for quite some time.
And was he was he leading the group as well? You know, like when you were telling us about these fighter pilots before, it was saying that the best pilot was the one that was leading the group, and they didn't pull rank. Was there anything similar like that? Did he have other people lead the group sometimes if they were better pilots, or was he just... So that's why he was a captain.
Yeah, well, he was appointed group commander, and that is not a rank, that is a position, and the best pilot gets that position. He gets appointed to that position.
Right.
So regardless of the rank, more or less.
So it was the same as the other pilot that you told us about that got put to that position.
Yeah, but I'm not sure whether it changed any, whether they made it even more strictly the best pilot to lead the element. Maybe they even went over to that policy a bit more when the war in Russia was on. But I would think that even in Spain they already employed that, even though I haven't specifically read about that. But as I said, he was group commander from early on, and this had nothing to do with the rank.
You can see it's all to do with ability and not to do with previous status or aristocratic status, but all down to ability.
Yes.
No diversity quotas there. Dennis, have you got a comment you'd like to make on this so far?
Well, not really. No, it's just it took me a while to realise who it was, because obviously I had put him in the documentary and it was obviously speaking, but I didn't really know enough about his career his name was first mentioned. It didn't click. But what always amuses me is the fact that after Versailles they were left with no air force at all and no navy and only 100,000 army. And when people see Hitler building up his forces, they always assume it were for war. But when you're living next door to Russia, or Soviet Union, you know, 100,000 army is not going to do any good.
Well, they always say that it was a war economy, and that's what helped out with the money and the big boom in the economy. But how could that happen if it was secretly rearming? That wouldn't help the economy in any way at all. It would all be hidden. So, you know, both ideas, I think, can be shown to be wrong.
Yeah, well, I mean, he withdrew from the League of Nations, didn't he? Probably because it was built on the same grounds as what United Nations were later built on, Communist Manifesto. But he didn't see anybody else disarming, so he had no reason not to arm when, you know, nobody else would take him up on the disarmament.
Well, I think that was part of the Versailles Treaty, wasn't it? They were all supposed to be looking to disarming, and all they did was disarm Germany and then carry on arming themselves.
Yeah, it's a surprise, that, isn't it?
Not much.
Yes, and Adolf Hitler actually offered to restrict the armament and even have no tanks, no artillery, if the others would do that.
Exactly.
But
yeah.
The other powers refused to do so, and so he thought, okay, I can also arm up my nation if you don't want to disarm.
Yeah. He's a genuine peacemaker.
Exactly.
Genuine peacemaker.
And I mentioned before this book, The War That Had Many Fathers, by this German ex-general.
Yes,
And he actually made an analysis because of his experience. He was also responsible for armaments when he was doing duty. He was a post-World War II general, German general. And he compared the amount of arms that each nation had. He compared that with what Germany was producing. And this was a defensive footing. Even in 1939, Germany had much less in airplanes, in tanks, in artillery, everything compared to the enemies, basically.
I totally agree.
Had to have defend yourself, especially if the rest are rearming. I believe next week he doesn't see eye to eye with Hermann Göring. Is that right? There's a bit of a disagreement between the two. Am I thinking of the right character there?
Yeah, that's right. They had quite the fallout, but actually Göring later came around and told Galland he had been right on the issue that they had.
Thanks for that, Schmidt. I'm sure our listeners will be looking out for part two next week.
In July of 1940, he was promoted to major, and the 26th, that is Jagdgeschwader 26, moved to the Pas-de-Calais, where they remained for the next 18 months. In August, Field Marshal Kesselring presented the Knight's Cross to Galland after he had scored his 17th air victory. I'm going to read something to give an impression in Galland's own words of what it was like to fight the British over their own homeland. So I'm quoting here, "The second phase of the Battle of Britain, lasting from July 24th to August the 8th, 1940, was essentially a fighter battle. On its opening day, I was with my squadron for the first time in action over England. Over the Thames estuary, we got involved in a heavy scrap with Spitfires, which were screening a convoy. Together with the staff flight, I selected one formation as our prey. We made a surprise attack from a favorably higher altitude. I glued myself to the tail of the plane, flying outside on the left flank. During a right-handed turn, I managed to get in a long burst. The Spitfire went down almost vertically. I followed it until the cockpit cover came flying toward me, and the pilot bailed out. I followed him down until he crashed into the water. His parachute had failed to open. The modern Vickers Supermarine Spitfires were slower than our planes by about 10 to 15 miles per hour, but could perform steeper and tighter turns. The older Hawker Hurricane, which was at that time still frequently used by the English, compared badly with our Messerschmitt 109, as regards speed and rate of climb. Our armament and ammunition was also undoubtedly better. Another advantage was that our engines had injection pumps instead of the carburetors used by the British, and therefore they did not conk out through lack of acceleration in critical moments during combat. The British fighters usually tried to shake off pursuit by a half roll or half roll on top of a loop, while we simply went straight for them with wide open throttle and eyes bulging out of our sockets. During this first action, we lost two aircraft. That was bad, although at the same time, we had three confirmed kills. We were no longer in doubt that the Royal Air Force would prove a most formidable opponent. Galland and his men flew two or three sorties per day, and again, in his own words, the physical and mental strain on the pilots was considerable. The ground personnel and the planes themselves were taxed to the limit. From takeoff to crossing the channel at the narrowest point took about half an hour, as their fighters only allowed for about 80 minutes of flight. They had roughly only 20 minutes to complete their task, which was usually freie Jagd, or free hunt, free chase, or targets of opportunity. After about a month of action on the Channel coast, Galland was ordered back to Germany to Karinhall, Göring's country residence. Mulders had also been invited, and Göring awarded to both of them the pilot-slash-observer badge in gold with diamonds, a decoration that only Göring could give. However, Göring made it clear to them that he was not satisfied with the performance of the fighter force concerning the protection of the bombers. Göring thought that the main problem was that the commanders of the fighter force were too old, because they consisted mainly of World War I veterans. He wanted to replace them with younger, more aggressive men, and he wanted to start with Galland and Mulders by appointing them to the position of squadron commodores. And here we can revisit the question of last week concerning the question of whether someone with a high rank was in command in the air, or the most skilled. So I'm going to quote again. "I was not at all satisfied with this and said so openly to Göring. My group is a pleasure to me and the responsibility sufficient. I'm also scared of being tied to the ground, of not seeing enough action. Don't worry," said Göring. He then explained to me that the main idea of his new measure was that the squadron should be led in the air by the commodore himself, and this commodore could only be the most successful pilot of the entire squadron. So this seems to indicate that Göring himself was largely responsible for introducing that measure.
Was that by the most kills? Is that what they mean by the most successful, got the most targets?
Yes, the Germans would call it air victories. Yes, that is to shoot down an enemy plane. Yes, that would be the measure of success. So, when Göring visited the fighter pilots at the coast 2 weeks later, he told them that he wanted them to stay with the bombers to better protect them. Galland thought this was madness, as it took away the advantage of the fighters, especially the 109, which was faster than the Spitfire, but less maneuverable. When Göring asked Mulders and Galland whether they had any requests, Mulders replied that he would like 109s with more powerful engines, which was granted. When he turned to Galland, the following happened. Quoting, "And you?" Göring asked. "I did not hesitate long. I should like an outfit of Spitfires for my squadron." After I had blurted this out, I received rather a shock. It was not really meant that way, of course. Fundamentally, I preferred our Messerschmitt 109 to the Spitfire, but I was unbelievably vexed at the lack of understanding and the stubbornness with which the command gave us orders we could not execute, or only incompletely, as a result of many shortcomings for which we were not to blame. Such a brazen-faced impudence made even Göring speechless. He stamped off, growling as he went. This scene is actually reenacted in the 1969 British movie The Battle of Britain. The role of Major Falke in that movie is based on Galland. And here follows another quote that addresses two more issues. The one of what Galland thought of the British pilots, and what we mentioned some weeks ago about the limited range of the 109s. Quote, "I can only express the highest admiration of the British fighter pilots who, although technically at a disadvantage, fought bravely and indefatigably. They undoubtedly saved their country in this crucial hour." The short range of the Messerschmitt 109 became more and more of a disadvantage. "During a single sortie of my wing, we lost 12 fighter planes. not by enemy action, but simply because flying time, the bombers we were escorting had not yet reached the mainland on their return journey. Five of these fighters managed to make a pancake landing on the French shore with the last drop of fuel. Seven of them landed in the drink. And drink is in quotation marks. He means, of course, the channel. End quote. On the 24th of September 1940, Galland had his 40th air victory over the Thames estuary. He was the third member of the German armed forces to receive the oak leaves to the Knight's Cross, after Eduard Dietl and Werner Mölders. Ordered to Berlin, he was presented with the decoration by Adolf Hitler at the Reich Chancellery. Galland was alone with him while they had a long conversation. Galland expressed his admiration for the British. Hitler agreed with him and told him he had the greatest respect for the Anglo-Saxon race. On December the 5th, Galland had his 57th air victory, which meant he was the most successful fighter pilot of the war at that point, surpassing the score of his friend and rival Mölders. In early 1941, Jagdgeschwader 26 was re-equipped with the new 109F version, which was quite an improvement over the E version that they had been flying previously. Galland did not like the fact that it only had one 20mm cannon instead of two, like the E version had. The early F models even only had a 15mm cannon. However, the F version is much faster, and the fact that the cannon fires through the propeller hub instead of being wing-mounted makes for easier aiming.
That must have been quite a challenge when you think about it, having the guns mounted on the wings instead of right in front of you, so they're sort of on either side of you. And he doesn't seem very easily pleased either, does he? He's, whatever he's given, he's not really, he doesn't really seem to be completely happy with it. He's always wanting that little bit more, isn't he?
No, he certainly wasn't an easy subordinate for anyone that was in command over him. And yes, he seems to have had this drive to always strive for the best and never being satisfied with what is available. And yes, I agree, these two cannons that were mounted in the wing were much harder to aim. If you have one cannon that is aligned with the fuselage of the airplane, it's much easier to aim. The Germans actually had quite sophisticated aiming mechanisms, especially compared to the Russians. But still, it was not easy, from everything I have read, to aim accurately with these wing-mounted cannons.
Especially not when you think of the recoil. You think you're firing something from the wing, it's going to knock the wing out slightly, isn't it? Especially if one of the cannons stops firing, and you've only got one on one wing that's actually firing, it's going to knock the plane's balance and direction out, I would have thought.
Yes, I would imagine so. And actually, jamming of the cannon was not something that was uncommon. It did happen, not every day, but it did happen sometimes.
They're taking incredible risks, aren't they? You think what they're actually doing. And then you're getting all the way up the Thames estuary, and then getting all the way back to Germany, and doing that safely, and doing that night after night. And the British fighters as well doing that. Even though the British were doing these firebombing, it's still incredibly brave of them to go out and brave this enemy fire, fighting for what they thought was a just war. Mistakenly, as we know, because of propaganda. But that still doesn't take away the bravery and the courage of these men that were willing to lay down their lives for their people, does it?
Oh, definitely. And from everything I've read and researched, there was no German pilot that had any that looked down on British pilots in any way. And concerning the stress that they had, I have often read that they would be in terror before taking off, even the experienced pilots. But for some reason, once they were in the air, it was all gone. The fear was all gone, and they were able to completely concentrate on their tasks.
Hoping that if they did get shot down, that they would be treated reasonably and they would be rescued and just be treated as a prisoner of war and not actually, you know, shot while they were a sitting duck, as happens today in the Middle East, where they shot down that Russian pilot and then just shot him when he was a sitting duck, basically, instead of treating him with honour. You can see that back then, even though they were fighting against one another, they honoured each other, the bravery of each other, and the fact that they were of the same race, that they were both of the white race. They knew that they were brothers that were fighting, so they weren't going to treat them in any inhuman way. That came after the war, the inhumane treatment at the instigation of the Jews. But I don't want to take us too far off track, Schmidt, if you'd like to continue.
Yes, but you are right about this. I agree with that. And well, in the East, it was a very different situation because Russia was ruled by the Jewish-led Bolsheviks. So German pilots that had to bail out over there had a really... they were basically mutilated and murdered most of the time. But okay, let's go on with Galland's. On April the 15th, it was Theo Osterkamp's birthday. He's another Knight's Cross holder, a fighter pilot and World War I veteran. Galland and Mulders were invited to come over to Le Touquet, where he was stationed. So Galland packed a huge basket of lobsters with some bottles of champagne, put them into his 109F and took off with his wingmen. He could not resist the temptation to make a detour, and he shot down three Spitfires near Dover. On his way back, he noticed that his plane was noticeably slower than that of his wingmen. When he came into land at Le Touquet, the ground staff waved frantically and fired red light signals. Then it dawned on him. All this time he had been flying with his landing gear out. It probably came out when in the heat of battle he had accidentally pressed the button for it. So when he intended to lower the gear for landing, he actually retracted it, and he would have made a belly landing had it not been for the attentive ground personnel. The birthday party was saved. Right after having achieved 70 air victories, he was himself shot down and nearly burned to death in his 109. When he was back at his base, his comrades celebrated his birthday. It was not his actual birthday, but German pilots would celebrate one of their comrades narrowly escaping death and calling it his birthday. Later that night, a telegram arrived from Berlin. It was from Adolf Hitler, congratulating him on receiving the sword to the Knight's Cross, an award that was previously unknown. The oak leaves had been the highest, and Galland was the first to receive it. Technically, he received it for 69 air victories, as he had been flying solo, and nobody had been there to witness his 70th. Galland was ordered not to fly anymore, most likely because his death would have been bad for general morale, but he disobeyed that order. In August, Douglas Barber, whom Mr. Weiss mentioned in a previous episode, was Saint-Omer, France. Galland made sure he was taken care of, entertained him as best as he could, and personally asked permission from Göring to have the damaged artificial leg of Bader replaced. Bader was famous for flying with two artificial legs. They managed to send a message to the British to ask them to send over a spare artificial leg, which was already in store at Bader's home. They offered that a British transport airplane could land near the coast and unload the leg. What the British did instead, however, was to bomb the airbase at Saint-Omer and other nearby targets while also dropping a box with the spare leg. What Galland thought of that, in his own words again, is this, quote, "This was not a very friendly reply to our well-meant proposal. To our minds, bombs and charity did not go together," end quote.
Well said. That's really quite something, isn't it? You just drop a box of spare legs off and a few bombs along the way. Oh, incredible. Sorry, please continue. Unless, Dennis, have you got anything that you'd like to say on this just at this moment while we paused for a minute?
Yeah, well, it doesn't surprise me really about dropping the bombs along with the legs. The early part about running out of petrol, I often hear comments about how Germany was a threat to America, which goes to show just how much of a threat they wasn't to America when they're only just getting back from across the channel. So some people really need educating on the situation of that. Even the Americans took chances to drop the atomic bombs in Japan. So that was a major problem to all sides in the war, I would have thought.
Oh yeah, I mean, just the fuel. How are they, if they're going to have problems with the fuel, getting across the channel, how on earth are they going to cross the Atlantic to go bombing a country the size of America? And you think of the size of America as well. I don't know how they ever managed to con the people into believing that.
Well, I know Hitler was looking for a long distance bomber at some stage late in the war because it was hoping it could possibly inflict some pain on, like, say, New York, like the pain that the Germans were getting. But it just proved impossible for that era.
Basically, the Americans were flying from bases that were nearby, weren't they? They were flying from Britain and other allies that were against Germany.
Exactly.
What would the Germans do? Maybe fly to Japan, but they still got quite some distance. You've still got the Pacific Ocean to cross to eventually get to America. It's just a ludicrous bit of propaganda that shouldn't have managed to gain any traction at all when you think about it. Okay, Schmidt, have you had your sip of water? Are you ready to continue?
Yes. I would also have to say some things about what people perceive to be what Hitler wanted, like total world conquest, but don't get me started on that. So later that month, he surpassed the mark of 80 air victories, which was the record held by Manfred von Richthofen, a Red Baron in World War I. But his friend and rival, Werner Mölders, had beaten him to it in June. There was several times this back and forth between the two, one of them getting an award as the first soldier ever and the other one catching up and then vice versa again. Galland's Geschwader was re-equipped with the Focke Wulf 190, but he kept some 109s for his personal use. He did fly the Focke Wulf, but he also kept some 109s around, basically, for him personally. He really must have loved that airplane. In November, he shot down yet another Spitfire, bringing his tally to 96. To his dismay, he was again forbidden from flying, but this time also appointed General of the Fighters, a position that made him responsible for the training and tactics of the fighter pilots. There was, however, soon an important task for him. The German battleships Scharnhorst and Gneisenau and the heavy cruiser Prince Eugen that lay in the French port of Brest were to be moved to Norway. To do that, they had to pass through the English Channel, and that meant facing the British Home Fleet, the coastal artillery, and the Royal Air Force. Galland's responsibility was to ensure that the German warships had a non-stop escort of fighters. The whole operation was called Operation Cerberus by the Germans and became also known as the Channel Dash. The Luftwaffe's part, the protective cover, was codenamed Operation Donnerkeil, or Thunderbolt in English. It was a complete success and demonstrated that Galland was not only a brilliant frontline pilot, but also very talented when it comes to logistics, organizational skill, and administration. As the war progressed and the British and American air forces terror bombed German cities, Galland and Göring often had opposing views on how to best counter these. Gallant never held back with his opinions and criticism, which Göring found hard to tolerate. In October 1943 at Castle Weldenstein, Göring and Gallant again had a heated discussion, with Göring getting louder and louder, shouting at Gallant, telling him he was sabotaging his orders and accusing him of not acting as a general should, that is, to execute the orders he was given by whatever means, basically without questioning them. Gallant replied by saying that he could not, quote, reconcile my conscience with the activities of a general such as he envisaged them, end quote.
What was he being asked to do then? What was he being asked to do that was upsetting his conscience so much? Do you know?
Well, there were so many issues, but first of all, Göring tended to accuse the fighter pilots of cowardice, and that was probably his way of dealing with the whole situation, that the war was turning very badly, the German cities were being bombed, and perhaps also that his own strategies hadn't worked. And then also they had very opposing views on how to deal with the incoming bomber waves. Gallant wanted to concentrate all the fighters in one spot, even if that meant leaving other spots unprotected for the moment. But to be able to pounce a whole, well, you probably know that they came in with hundreds of bombers, the Americans and the British at times. And he wanted to concentrate all the available fighters to do as much damage instead of spreading them out over Germany.
I was just wondering there whether it was, whether it was what he was being asked to attack that was getting his conscience. And I was thinking, you know, how could he be worried about what he's attacking when the Allies are firebombing these German cities?
It had nothing to do with that. Sorry for interrupting. No, it had to do with, I think, I will have to speak for Gallant, basically, but from what I researched and read, what he means by his conscience is that he was not, he would not simply carry out orders that he thought were wrong. So he always questioned the orders that were given to him if he thought they were not good for the war effort and for Germany as a whole.
Well, that gives us an idea of what it was like. It was an environment where they could that and where he could bring up his concerns and say that he didn't really agree with these orders. I mean, that's quite different from the usual military situation, I think, where you just have to obey the orders and that's it. And if you question them, then you're going to get court-martialed. And this guy questioned a lot of the orders that he was given, and yet he still won lots of medals, and he was still, put in charge, basically, and promoted, even though he was questioning these orders. So it shows you that there was a different environment there to what we had elsewhere in the military, and especially different to what we have today, I would say, anyway.
Yes, I would agree with that, but Gallant was indeed a very special case. I don't know if anyone else. Well, actually, come to think of it, Erich Hartmann also once wrote a letter to Göring, a very harsh letter where he accused him of sending these hardly trained German fighter pilots up in the air in very bad weather. And he actually called that a nearly criminal act, if I remember correctly. So, Gallant was not the only one to criticize actions that were ordered by the higher-ups. It was not uncommon at all in National Socialist Germany.
And they paid attention to it as well, didn't they? You know, they did pay attention to what was being said to them. Otherwise, they would have just, sacked the guys that were saying it. But they kept them on. Sorry, I'll keep interrupting you, Schmidt. Dennis, have you got anything that you'd like to add?
No, that's fine. It's interesting, I've got to be honest. I can remember watching a program actually a while back when the Spitfires, not long ago, we were celebrating. And you wouldn't get me one of them for all the tea in China, for sure.
Yeah, they're pretty flimsy machines, don't they, compared to today?
Oh, my word. Yeah. Hell yeah.
Held together with string and sellotape.
That's what we're like, yeah.
Okay, please do continue, Schmidt. Sorry for interrupting.
I don't mind these interruptions at all. I think it makes for a good flow. Maybe even the listeners would like to ask these questions that you are asking. So I think it's a good thing. So Gallant then formally asked Göring to relieve him from his command and to send him back to the front. Göring looked very surprised. After a long pause, he said with accentuated curtness, "Granted." On the same day, however, Gallant received a phone call from Göring's adjutant telling him to remain in his post for the time being. Sometime later, he learned that Göring wanted him to remain general of the fighters. And sometime after that, Göring apologized to him for the incident at the castle and asked Gallant to take his agitation at the time into account. In the meantime, Gallant had become very interested in the development of the Messerschmitt 262, the world's first operational military jet aircraft. After flying an early prototype, Gallant describes the experience as follows. "For the first time, I was flying by jet propulsion. No engine vibrations, no torque, and no lashing sound of the engine propeller. Accompanied by a whistling sound, my jet shot through the air. It was as though angels were pushing." End quote. The tensions between Gallant and Göring resurfaced from time to time, and then in January 1945, he was relieved of his command. This led to what became known as the Fighter Pilots Revolt, with many of the Luftwaffe's most decorated combat leaders taking Gallant's side. Gallant was effectively put under house arrest by Göring. When Adolf Hitler learned of this, however, he ordered that, quote, "all this nonsense was to stop immediately," end quote. In the end, Göring contacted Gallant and invited him to Karin Hall, his residence, where he promised him no further actions would be taken and that he would be given command of a unit of Messerschmitt 262 jet fighters. And he probably could have done no bigger favor to Gallant than that, because Gallant had never been really comfortable at his desk job. Gallant picked a number of the most experienced and highly decorated fighter pilots for this unit, which was officially called Jagdverband 44. Inofficially, however, it was called the Gallant Circus. He also asked Erich Hartmann to join them, but he declined, not wanting to leave behind his comrades at the Eastern Front. In the short time they still had, they managed to shoot down around 50 enemy aircraft. Seven of these were shot down by Gallant himself. That is after 3 years of not flying himself. Most of these were US-American B-26s. On the 21st of April, Göring visited him for the last time. He told Gallant that he, Gallant, had been correct in many of the arguments they had had. When parting, Göring told him, quote, "I envy you, Gallant, for going into action. I wish I were a few years younger and less bulky. If I were, I would gladly put myself under your command. It would be marvelous to have nothing to worry about but a good fight, like it was in the old days." End quote. And for people who don't know, Hermann Göring was a World War I fighter pilot and quite a successful one. At the very end of the war, Gallant ordered the remaining jet fighters of the unit to be destroyed and surrendered to the Americans. In April 1947, he was then finally released. There would be, of course, much more that could be told about Adolf Gallant. For example, he worked for the government of Argentina in the post-war years as a test pilot, instructor, and consultant with the Argentine Air Force. But to bring this presentation to an end, he died in Germany after a time of illness. He was in a hospital but wanted to return home and die in peace with his wife, Heidi, his son, and his daughter. He was given the last rites and died in the early morning of the 9th of February, 1996.
May he rest in peace. What a hero. His memory seems to have been better looked upon than some of the other National Socialists who sort of had their their careers tarnished, and they were accused of doing terrible things, which of course they didn't, and they tried to cover up some of their exploits. But Adolf Galland seems to still have quite a good reputation. I noticed that there was stamps made of him, and he's included in the, you know, the top 10 flying aces, or he's even named as the number one flying ace. So his memory seems to be quite treasured by people, as opposed to some of the others that fought in the war, I would say. Just as I came across looking up images for him, that's what I noticed, was that all over the world there was recognition of him and of him being such a good pilot. You know, there really were a lot of these heroes among the German side that we just don't really hear about, us English language speakers. I know I hadn't really heard of him before, but just noticing all of that, I mean, there's a lot on the, it's certainly a lot on the internet about him. I really appreciate you hearing that, Schmidt. That was, it's really interesting. There just seems to be an endless supply of these fantastic heroes of the white race that were on the German side. I mean, I couldn't really name you any of the British ones. I can think of Bulldog Drummond, but that's about it. You know, it's the Germans that had these real heroes, and of course they were the ones fighting on the losing side, so they were the underdogs as well. And what they actually had to fight with, when you think of all the resources that have been taken away from them, and they were doing everything on a shoestring budget, you know, trying to even make their own fuel where they didn't have access to oil and rubber and things like that. It's really quite amazing that they managed to last as long as they did, taking on the might of, you know, pretty much the rest of the world. It's an incredible story. It just would have been all the better if they'd actually won, of course. Now, Dennis, any comments that you'd like to make on that?
Well, I agree 100% with you about the fact that they lasted as long as they could. In fact, most of the battles that they did lose towards the end of war was only because of lack of fuel and other minerals. One comes to spring to mind, the Battle of the Bulge, where they made the breakthrough, tried to get to a certain point, you know, to drive the Americans, or at least get to a point where they could capture the Americans and negotiate some kind of a deal. But lack of fuel again. In fact, I heard at some point they had to steal fuel from captured American tanks. And that's how desperate they were. So, and of course, they had no air cover at that time because there's not enough fuel to fly the aeroplanes. So it was a pretty back to the wall kind of thing. And yet they still give it the best shot.
They fought right through till the very end, didn't they? You know, they kept fighting right up through to the very end. And when the British thought, well, they'll be demoralised by now, there was still graffiti appearing on the walls in Germany. You know, we're not going to back down. We love Hitler. And they were even more supportive of the National Socialists at the end of the war than they were at the beginning. You know, this is totally different to what we have been taught, isn't it?
Well, the brainwashing thing is always pushed, saying that the youth were brainwashed and even the older people at the end of the war were fighting, you know, when they realised that the war was over, that they should have surrendered. But we all know what happened eventually after the war anyway, when more Germans died than during the war. I think Hitler was well aware of this. I think he was hoping at some point that the Americans would see sense and turn on the Russians at some point, but it never happened. And now we know why, because the Russians were funded by the West anyway. No, it's a courageous war, but unfortunately they didn't pull it off, and that leaves us in the position we are today.